This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Today's show, what you need to know about heart disease. If you or someone you love has a heart attack, the cardiologist probably gives you a brief technical assessment of what's going on, and your anxiety levels are so high you only hear a fraction of what he says, and you remember even less. Typically, there's no discussion about psychological factors like dealing with stress and changes and how different your life is becoming. Cardiologist Dr. Joel Ochner and cardiac psychologist Dr. Jeremy Corifine stepped in to fill the gap with their just-released book, The No Bull Book on Heart Disease. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
The signs of a heart attack tend to be more clear for men than for women. How does a woman know whether these vague symptoms might be a heart attack?
First of all, they don't. That's the problem. Joel, go ahead, man.
Well, a lot of help you guys are.
No, it's a big problem. And look, first of all, your introduction was spot on because cardiologists tend to give some very technical jargon. They don't deal with the real stress issue, and that's a problem. It's a problem for men and women. Women are especially problematic, and it gets back to the fact that textbooks have been written by men for men, and therefore they describe symptoms that belong to men, and they really didn't take into account that possibly women experience a heart attack differently. And why shouldn't they? Because they're completely different species. I've only been married for about 15 years, but I know men and women are completely different. Women, they might have it, but for purpose of discussion, it's really, you have to look at women in premenopausal and postmenopausal.
Mm-hmm.
Postmenopausal, they will commonly feel symptoms like men. That's, pain in their chest, some shortness of breath, pressure. But premenopausal, they likely will not. They can feel fatigue. They can have some stomach pain. They can feel some right-sided chest pain. They're just not going to feel
nausea.
Nausea.
Jaw pain, back pain,
loading,
belching, just like a whole constellation of symptoms that are just going to be fundamentally different.
If a man goes to a doctor with these kind of complaints, well, the stress test is in 24 hours. The woman's going to see, maybe a gastroenterologist, maybe get a little Xanax and told maybe she's working too hard. That's the biggest problem.
So how do you keep that from happening and the women getting misdiagnosed and put off to the side?
What we do is we get interviewed by you and run around the country telling people that, and particularly telling women, that their doctors won't. The bottom line is they have got to understand that when they're not feeling well, they're going to have to consider their heart more as a primary or secondary than looking at something else. That is, if they're feeling fatigued.
Right. Jeremy's spot on. That's
if they're feeling fatigued, they have to say, wait a minute, this could be my heart. But now if they're 28 years old, yeah, the odds are it's not their heart. However, with the increasing in risk factors in our society, which is the increasing obesity, diabetes, and women having unbelievable amounts of stress, they are working harder and longer than they ever have in their history, that these symptoms, these risk factors are going to contribute to greater number of women getting heart disease at younger ages. So the truth is, if you're 40, and we'll just give a number of 40,
mm-hmm.
and you're just amazingly fatigued or just getting weird stomach problems, it's like you could have a blocked artery. I mean, you could drop dead of a heart attack. And I think that's coming. This is definitely the trend, that there are more and more people, more and more women in particular, are going to be diagnosed with heart disease earlier.
And the bottom line is that women are pretty much ignored. We were joking around last week, Mike, that last month was heart month. And I think the last
February was Heart Month, but February 6th was a specific day for women, like
day.
Recognizing women in heart
day
disease.
That we ignore women more than any other day, We just don't pay attention to women in our society with their symptoms. We just don't do it. We do a bad job.
Well, one of the statistics you cite was 1 in 25 women die from breast cancer and 1 in 2 die from heart disease, and yet women tend to be more afraid of breast cancer.
Oh, clearly.
Look, the breast cancer people have done breast cancer is nothing to laugh about. It's a horrible disease. Breast cancer people have done an incredible job terrifying women and doing great.
Terrifying them.
They do.
Right.
You ask any woman what you're afraid of dying of, it's breast cancer. You don't think of heart.
Well, it's not even dying. It's just like, what don't you want to get?
Right.
And
right.
Clearly, there's sexual, there's identity issues that are associated with breast cancer, and there's no doubt these are horrific things. But, women, as they get into the kind of late 40s, and in their 50s, they are getting heart disease, and they can die of heart disease. And the first, oftentimes for so many men and women, the first symptom is death.
And that's a bad symptom.
we'll put that in the bad category.
We'll say the sudden death is bad.
So am I hearing that for women under 40 and even 40 to 50, risk factors are probably the biggest thing to take into account, and routine screening is pretty critical?
But, you know, the routine risk factor, this is right up your alley that no one takes into account, is stress. You know, look, there's diabetes, there's high blood pressure, there's obesity, there's lack of exercise, there's smoking, all important things. But stress has got to be the number one thing out there.
Well, and the data supports it, because the truth is that more and more women, and I got to say this carefully, but more and more women are actually acting like men, which is in terms of the work-related stress. You know, something like 52% of our population, our work, of everybody who works in our country, about 52% make up of women. Women work, and what's happening is more and more women are not only working part-time, they're now working full-time, and they're coming home, and they got to do all the same home child-rearing responsibilities, where men certainly are getting involved, you know, traditionally, where it was 50 years ago, 100 years ago. But truthfully, women are under absolutely enormous stress. There's a client of mine just recommended a new book about the kind of the modern-day girl, and what the pressures that she is now experiencing is profoundly different than what was going on 30, 40 years ago. I mean, really kind of the 80s turned into kind of the modern-day kid.
It's just crazy.
And they're going to experience stress, and they're going to end up with clogged arteries.
That's very tricky, because what's stressful for one person, another person may take in stride, and everybody thinks they're under a lot of stress. How do you get objective about how much stress is causing heart disease?
You know, but before Jeremy gets into his whole, you know,
right,
psychological
thing, I won't go there. I won't do that.
I'm just going to say that, you know, I hear every day, you know, I see people every day, they have had heart attacks, and they always say, well, you know, they're handling their stress. You know what? I don't think anybody really does. I think we're all getting screwed with stress. I think it's like we're all getting pushed and shoved, and no matter how much you think you're handling it, you're not. You know, for the last 10 years or so, Jeremy has seen almost every one of my patients. And invariably, I'll say, look, you know, go see this guy. He's going to help you with stress and, you know, maybe some family issues and diet. And they almost all say, I don't have any stress. You know, when you peel back the layers of the onion a little bit, these people are incredibly stressed. So I don't believe anybody handles their stress. Jeremy, I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the thing is, I mean, Mike, you make a good point that there are some people who, you know, that deal with some elements of their life better than others. But what actually happened is the data doesn't support it. The truth is we are working longer hours than ever before. We work longer hours than anybody in history in the world. We're averaging about 55 hours of work per week. In addition to that, we're averaging a two-hour commute. Most people are profoundly sleep-deprived. They're up before 6 a.m., home after 6 p.m., and we have less than 10 days of paid vacation per year, men and women. And you start adding that up. Now, are people getting, quote-unquote, used to that? Just because they're used to it is not healthy. And on top of we have the highest rates of heart disease in the world. So people overseas who don't work like that, they come to our country, they start working like that, they get heart disease.
Jeremy always says, it's like, if you want to walk, you can walk on a flat surface all day. If you walk uphill all day, you can walk, but it's going to take more out of you. And pretty much we look at it, people are walking uphill all day long.
Just to counterbalance a little, there may be a little selection factor in that the people you see are the people who were either under a lot of stress or denying stress. And when people come from other countries, they also tend to adopt our eating habits and other lifestyle factors.
Oh, that's true.
Right, no, there's no doubt that that's a key component. But what's interesting is that variable is that they're going to start to, it takes about 15 years. But what's interesting is that if you start calculating why are people then eating the way they do, certainly, I mean, it is fast food is high fat, high sugar, high salt, and oftentimes very delicious. There's still now, there's elements of that it can be delicious. But what happens is they start working enormous hours. They start getting profoundly sleep deprived. So you start adding these things up, and before they know it, they're more irritable, they're more cranky, they're more angry, they're more stressed, they're in the car longer. These things start to add up. Now, is it everybody like this, or is it just the people that we see? But the thing is that Joel's going to see people who've got chronic hypertension. He's going to see people who are diabetic, or maybe pre-cardiac, or may not have necessarily had a heart attack, but they're coming in for stress tests. They're coming in for echocardiograms, who are enormous risk factors, and they're 47 years old. Now, if you're 92, Mike, and you just had your first heart attack, well, you know, God bless, you're doing fine. That's just the way, you know, that's not what we're talking about. We're just talking about the masses that we're seeing of all ages who are basically getting younger and younger.
Yeah, I've seen just so many men around 50 years old keel over dead from a heart attack. What are the men missing in terms of symptoms or ignoring the symptoms?
Joe?
Well, I mean, the bottom line, I think everybody's missing everything. I think in general, you know, doctors are doing a poor job of diagnosing it, paying attention to people's symptoms. And I think people underplay their symptoms, and people don't want to deal with what's going on. You know, I'm a big proponent of telling people they have to take stock of what they're doing. I mean, I see people all the time. They're overeating, not exercising, smoking, got high blood pressure. You know what? Bad things are going to happen to you. That's just the way of the world.
It's not rocket science.
I look at it like, what are we all? We're missing the signs. You know, the signs are right there if you want to see them.
You know, Mike, this is what drives Joel nuts. I mean, literally, since the day I've started working with him, Joel's being really polite right now, but I'm just telling you, guys come in at all ages, and they literally look at him, and they go, how did this happen? And Joel looks at him and says, you have got to be kidding me. I mean, you weigh 320 pounds, you're diabetic, I mean, all these things. And you know, you've got chronic sleep apnea that you're not treating, you've got stress, you've got financial problems, your marriage things, you've got low back pain. And you add all these things up, and they go, I can't, you know, I'm 50. How did this happen? So what we're really commenting on is that people actually believe, because they're just used to it, they're used to going to a restaurant and getting a plate that is 16 inches wide, that's full of about 5 servings of pasta, okay, that's got about enough calories to sink a battleship, and that's standard, that's norm, mm-hmm. okay? And they're used to it, and they go, how did this happen? And we're like, well,
we call it a disconnect, Mike. People are disconnected from like what's going on around them and what's going on inside them. And my favorite one is that, you know, I had a patient just the other day. He's about 52, and you know, this guy is a diabetic. He smokes. He's high blood pressure. He's about 280 pounds. He had a heart attack. He goes, no. I go, look, you know, you got a heart attack and you've got all these issues. He goes, no, it's genetic. You know, it's not my fault. No, it doesn't work like that. You know, if you're, you know, young, you're 30, and you have everybody in your family dying of heart disease real early, you might be genetic. But for everybody else, you know, that's a bunch of crap. Can I say that on your show?
Sure.
I guess I just did. You can edit it, I guess. But the bottom line is that people really need to understand that heart disease is a behavioral problem. Yes, there are some genetics, and you got some bad genes in the family, and I'm sorry, but that's not what's killing you. That's not what's causing heart attacks. What's causing heart attacks are people not doing what they're supposed to do. Bottom line.
So genetics is a minor part
of... It depends on the person, you know. If you're 80 years old and you had a heart attack, it's probably not genetics, you know. If you're 27, yeah, maybe it is. But pretty much everybody in the middle, you know, look, people can have genetics in the family. You know, you can have a mother and father dying of heart disease. But basically, it's what you do with yourself that's going to cause the problem or not cause the problem.
And it's also severity. You know, Joel's going to see some people who may just get a small blockage at a particular age. They don't have any risk factors. They, you know, they may be 55 years old, and, you know, they may be living somewhat of a stressful life, but they've reasonable health. And then we can say, okay, look, you may have a little bit of gene.
Yeah, but Jeremy, in general, you know what?
That's not what we see.
The stress thing is much more than, like I said, you peel back a layer.
Right.
There's something there. Mike, I had a patient I saw this morning. This guy came in the hospital. He's actually 47, right? He's a perfect example. And he came with chest pain. And I said to the guy, look, you know, you're pretty healthy. You're not overweight. What's going on? He goes, well, you know, my cholesterol's good. This is good. I go, is there anything wrong? You know, anything in your life? He goes, well, I had a little problem over the weekend. I said, what? He goes, well, my son died.
Mm.
I said, what? He goes, maybe that's causing a little bit of stress. Like, people are so far disconnected from what's going on around them, they're like, yeah, maybe that was a stressful issue, you know?
Right,
not,
and then...
Not the brightest human being, but
right.
but common.
Right,
you know?
and then one notch below that is that I'll see people have tremendous amount of somatic complaints, body complaints. They'll have irritable bowel syndrome. They'll have chronic migraines. They're chronic palpitations, so they're not quite yet a heart attack away, and then... They'll come in and they'll get referred to me maybe through Joel or through their internist somehow just to, quote, would you distress or mood or anxiety, and they're not making the link that lifestyle, that what's going on, their back pain and their marriage and their finances are just ripping their gut to shreds.
Jeremy, here's the other side of the problem. Doctors often don't make the link either. One of our favorite patients, and we'll call this guy, we'll call him Bob, he's an African-American gentleman who came to my office. He was referred because his doctor couldn't control his high blood pressure. He was on five different medicines, amazing doses, and his blood pressure was through the roof. Now this guy walks in my office. He's limping. He's got his arm in a sling. He looks terrible. So I go, hey, you know, before we talk about your blood pressure, like, what happened to you? It turns out the guy was in a horrible accident. He had a horrible pain in his back. He couldn't walk. He hated his wife, and he was getting fired at his job. You couldn't put enough medicine in this guy ever to control his blood pressure. So, you know, the approach we took is basically, I said, look, I'm not worried about your blood pressure today. Your head's probably not going to blow off. I sent it to a friend of ours who deals with chronic pain. Jeremy took care of his head. And you know what? Now the guy's on, you know, it took about a year. The guy's on one medicine, and he's got great blood pressure. But the problem was not, you know, the problem is the doctors just are so easy to throw another pill onto the fire and send them on their way.
That's so a whole nother.
As much as patients need to see what's going on, doctors can easily do a bad job. And some do a great job, but a lot of them really don't.
Yeah, that's a whole nother topic. I'm going nuts on. I think, I don't know. I don't know if I want to go there now, but I'm just, I agree. Joel makes a great point about, you know, physicians, even though individual physicians, some of them are very good and very talented, but at the end of the day, they're spending less and less time. They do not get paid for time. Doctors don't get paid for time, and as a result, they're spending less time with their patients, and they're basically providing poorer medical intervention. There's no doubt.
And on the other hand, you know, patients want the blue pill or the pink pill, the red pill to take care of their problem. They come in the office, you know, they don't want to know that they can get their cholesterol down about 20% by exercising and not getting two double Big Macs for breakfast. They want the pink pill, and then they take the pill, and then, you know, their cholesterol comes down, and then they stop the pill, and they can't understand why it comes back up again. This is a behavioral problem. Behaviors are completely out of control in this country.
And the kind of doctor feedback you're talking about is very time-intensive, with medicine becoming more and more 5- and 10-minute medicine, and then the media makes it sound like, well, it's all cholesterol or all lack of a pill.
Exactly.
The media would tell you to put Plavix and Mevacor in people's drinking water, and they're going to be okay. Doesn't work like that.
Not even close.
We'll get back to Dr. Ochner and Dr. Corfine in just a moment. I'm delighted to share with you that I've been selected to be one of the faculty for the 2009 Therapist Leadership Virtual Conference, which is this April 20th through April 24th. The faculty reads like a who's who of therapy, with Bill O'Hanlon, Chloe Madonis, Michael Yapo, Jeffrey Zeig, and Ofer Zur, and half a dozen other leading therapists. Rather than having to travel to a conference, it'll all be done by phone. You just call in on a Bridgeline number, and you'll be connected to the conference. You'll be able to ask the presenter questions by phone in the convenience of your own home. You can also get an MP3 of the presentations. If you're a therapist, you don't want to miss this. If you're a marriage and family therapist or a licensed clinical social worker in California or Florida, you can also get 16 continuing education credits. If you aren't a therapist, but you always wanted to look under the curtain and learn what therapists think and do, this is a great opportunity to learn about the cutting edge of therapy. The conference focuses on positive psychology, family therapy, hypnosis, and practice building. Further information on the conference is on my website, agelesslifestyles.com. That's agelesslifestyles.com. agelesslifestyles.com. I hope you join me for this exciting conference. And now back to Dr. Ochner and Dr. Corfine. Well, I want to shift gears. One of the things that you guys do so beautifully in the Noble Book of Heart Disease is you describe step by step what a patient goes through. A lot of times when a person is confronted with an angiogram, it's now. Can you walk us through what an angiogram is like?
Yeah, I probably have more of my Elliot than Jeremy's, I guess.
Joel, I'm going to pass that buck to you, my friend.
An angiogram is a diagnostic test where we actually go inside a patient and take a picture of the arteries. It's done in a room that looks like an operating room. It's called a cath lab. And what's going to happen is that a patient's going to go into an area, it's going to get an IV put in their arm, going to get wheeled into this cath lab. Their right groin in general is going to be shaved and prepped with some cold solution that's going to not feel so good. And then they're going to put a drape over the patient, just like you're in surgery. At that point, the doctor will come in, usually. It's in the right groin. He'll push down on it.
Is it the patient is often unconscious? I mean,
neck, yeah, usually.
Right.
There's different schools of thought on that. My patients are unconscious as I can get them unconscious, because if it was me, I don't want to be the hell awake during the thing. But a lot of doctors don't. They let their patients stay awake. I don't know. I think it's a cruel form of torture, personally. But usually at the point that I'm starting to poke in their groin, they're sleeping. I always tell my cath lab staff, this is not a procedure that mirrors anybody talking to me except them. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear the patient talking. I want them to be dreaming. So we give them a medicine called Versed, usually, which is nice because it has a big amnesic effect. The patient remembers nothing that happened to them. So we're gonna press in the groin. We're gonna put a little local anesthetic in there. You're gonna feel like a little sting, and after that, the patient is only gonna feel some pressure. There's no pain involved. We're gonna put a tube into the artery all the way up into the heart, and we inject into that tube it's called contrast, and we actually get a picture of the arteries. So the whole thing in general, from beginning to end, it takes about usually 20 minutes. It could take longer. It could take, hours, depending on people's anatomy. But that's the whole thing.
It's the gold standard, though.
And for now, if you look at Oprah or other shows, they're going to tell you can do these fancy CTs, but those are not there yet. Right now, it's the gold standard.
So you're watching what's going on cameras. How much information are you getting from watching the TV monitors?
You mean me or the patient?
You.
Hopefully the patient's not watching anything. They're sleeping. Me, I get a picture of the arteries that are actually supplying the blood to your heart as you are laying there and you have your heart beating.
So you can see where there are buildups and blockages?
I can see blockages, yes. And then if we need to fix them, the next procedure is something called an angioplasty, where we put a wire across the blockage and a balloon in the same area. We inflate the balloon, sort of crushing the blockage. Then we put a stent in. A stent looks like the spring at the end of a pen. We open it up, and it provides a scaffolding to keep the artery open.
If it's in the right area, when they can do that?
It usually is.
Okay.
Yeah.
A lot of the media has talked about CAT scans and other tests as superseding.
The media talks about ultra-fast CT scans. It's called Heart Check America.
Well, or other. It's just, is
that's
it just only Heart Check, Joe?
What's that?
Is it just Heart Check? It can be the other. It can be just the CT scans.
They've done the most commercial. They have the most commercial applications of it. That's the big one out there. Cardiologists, if they're worth anything, call this a test looking for an application, meaning it's completely useless.
That sounds like the body scans. Are they doing CAT scans specifically just on the heart?
The body scan, they just, they zoom in on the heart. Same concept. This scan looks for the presence of calcium deposits in the arteries, and you get this thing, at the end of it, you get what's called a calcium score. The problem is that as we age, all of us, every single one of us, start getting calcium deposits around our arteries. It's a normal part of aging. And this scan, it does not look for calcium deposits in the arteries. I don't give a rat's ass about calcium deposits around the arteries. It doesn't matter.
But the people would argue that if you got a lot of calcium around the arteries, you probably have calcium.
People are all wrong.
I know.
That's the beauty of this. It's complete bill of goods. Cost the patient $350. Take the money, go to Vegas, put it on black. You're going to get better results. It just does you no good.
We're talking with Dr. Joel Ochner, who's a board-certified cardiologist who works closely with Dr. Jeremy Corfine, a cardiac psychologist. They practice in Chicago and host a weekly two-hour radio call-in show called The Doctors Are In on WKRS 1220 AM. And their just-out book is The Noble Book on Heart Disease, Real Answers to Winning Back Your Heart. And it's a bargain at only $12.95.
It's already discounted on Amazon.com.
It's actually, price is going up because it's a bargain, but I think you can't get them anymore, so they're already like...
They printed five.
Yeah, right.
And the website is NobleDocs, NobleDocs.com. Anything else we ought to say about the book or the website?
I think the thing is Joe and I would talk about how we practice and kind of our philosophy of what we're doing, but I think the core issue, really what the book does, and I think Joe feels very strongly about this as well as I do, but heart books are not readable. They fundamentally are. It's kind of the godfather of cardiology. It's a guy named Dr. Dean Ornish, who's a brilliant, wonderful cardiologist who's done some amazing things and really tried to push our society to understanding more about heart disease. And his book is wonderful, but it's literally in tiny print, and it's not readable. You cannot have heart disease or say, hey, look, here's for the plane ride, or you're sitting on the crapper and you want to pick up a book and learn a little bit about heart disease. It can't be done.
Bottom line is that if you need a heart disease book, you know somebody has one, you have a problem, you either go online, you go to Barnes & Noble, and even the idiot, you know, the dummy's guide to heart disease.
It's not real legible.
I'm a cardiologist. I can't understand it. There's nothing out there that's going to answer the basic questions. Okay, I've got a problem. What do? I got a test. What's going to happen to me? This book basically goes through it at a very basic, simple level.
It's kind of how we practice. That's the whole idea. It doesn't answer every question about heart disease. No, that's not possible.
It's not meant
to. But it's going to give you a feel. It's going to really kind of give you, it's going to be like a catalyst to go, I think I understand what's going on here and what I have to do. And it's very clear.
We hope that at some point in the book people had that moment that go, now I get it.
Yeah.
That's all we're aiming for.
And that's what we aim for in our practice.
You want more information? See Dr. Ornish and read that thing. I don't want to read it, but you can.
Right, good luck.
Yeah.
No disrespect to him. He's a great guy. We just can't read his book.
Love him.
And No Bull nicely balances both the physical parts of it, but also the psychological parts that tend to get ignored. And even Dr. Ornish's book doesn't really get into that perspective of it.
Well, he'll talk about meditation, he'll talk about relaxation, and he'll do the whole guru stuff, and it's really good. It's just not fundamentally practical.
He talks about what to do, but he doesn't talk about the stress and the psychology behind it. He just says, hey, you got to meditate. And
well, Mike, you're bringing up a bigger question, because if what Jeremy and I propose works, why doesn't every cardiologist send every one of their patients to a cardiac psychologist? Because, I mean, I always tell patients, look, I'm a plumber, I get you through the problem. Jeremy's the guy who's going to fix you. He's going to cure you. He's going to keep you on this planet more than, you know, longer.
Well, it's collaboratively. And,
well, the problem is that most cardiologists don't buy into this. I mean, we don't know of any other cardiologists around in our area, anyhow, that actually sends their patients
to a cardiac psychologist. Extraordinarily rare. It's just that you would think that, oh, this is a no-brainer. Like, person smoking and, you know, they're overweight and they're stressed and they're crying in their office. And
I mean, how many times you go to your cardiologist and these patients, you know, they smoke and they're stressed, like Jeremy said, what the guy say, he goes, look, you know, we just put a stent in you, now stop smoking, start exercising, eat better, and I'll see you in 6 months. Now that does your world good, doesn't it? That's completely useless, because they're going to come back in 6 months smoking more and fatter than they were before.
Well, a cardiac psychologist is going to get the cardiologist better results. Why is there so much resistance?
Well, there's two reasons. First of all, there's not enough of Jeremy to go around. That's the first thing. But more importantly, you know what? You can't make a lot of money on this. And unfortunately, you know, that's what it comes down to. The third thing is that cardiologists, like doctors, don't like saying, hey, I know you came to see me for your heart problem, but go see this guy because he's really going to fix it. They want to be the guy to say, okay, we're going to take care of these issues, you know? If you have a smoking issue, chew this gum, you know?
More meds, more advice. More meds, more meds, more advice, but not more treatment.
No more treatment. They don't have the time or the expertise. Like I did too many years of residency, you know, fellowship, 3 years of fellowship. You know how much time I spent on cardiac psychology? About half an hour my last year. They said, hey, you should know about this. That was it.
In the typical cardiac rehab program, is there much cardiac psychology going on?
Well, I try and meet everybody in a cardiac rehab program.
That's unusual, Jeremy.
Right, I try and meet everybody.
Local hospital, I'm the director of the program.
Right.
And Jeremy sees everybody, but if you sample cardiac rehab programs throughout the country, only a small minority of them have a psychologist that actually sees all patients. They just don't do it.
Right. And so I see them, I do a brief eval, and at least introduce what I do and get to know them and then provide them with a nugget or two of information that really can try and get them in the right direction. At the same time, you know, I'm not going to sit here and say which person could use additional services, but I kind of introduce myself to them. If their cardiologist says, go see Chlorphine, they'll follow up.
Yeah, but they all can use your services.
Well, I don't deny that. Most of them can, for sure.
You don't have 200 hours in the week. You know, that's the problem.
Right.
So, Jeremy, if someone is not in Chicago and doesn't have access to your services in particular, but after hearing us today says, I need to talk with a psychologist, is there a lot of unique part about cardiac psychology?
Yeah, that's a great question, Mark. This is the direction I'd go in. If there's someone who's not, you know, certainly in Chicago, but even if they're in Chicago, they're not in our neighborhood, the idea is they want to find a psychologist who specializes in what's called health psychology. And there are many. That part of my training, most of my training was actually done in major medical centers working with individuals who are dealing with medical issues. I spent most of my time helping people with heart, but I spent a lot of time with pain and cancer as well. And there's many programs throughout the United States, all throughout the United States, that train psychologists that focus in on health issues. And in my, you know, certainly Joel and I, we're focusing on cardiac, but there's a lot of good health psychologists who certainly can...
How do they find one?
Well, what they're going to have to do is first they're going to have to call an insurance company. I mean, the truth is, call an insurance company and type in and find the local area psychologist, and there could be bios on them. Okay, they could also go to also major medical centers. Most major medical centers in major metropolitan cities, in any major city.
But you might get asked you a question.
They're going to have health psychologists.
Are they
on
looking
staff.
For a PhD? They looking for what?
No, PhD, clinical psychologist.
Okay, it's got to be. Okay. You're not looking for the little psychotherapist kind of person.
No, you got to find a PhD, licensed
PhD.
Clinical psychologist specializing in health psych. So I would even start with most major medical centers.
Go back. You need a PhD or do you need a licensed clinical psychologist?
It is a PhD. You can't be a licensed. You cannot be licensed. If you're licensed, you're a doctorate level in clinical psych.
You know, a lot of the hospitals have psychologists on staff, and if a psychologist is going to be on the staff of a hospital, they are bound to have pretty good health background, so that might be one of the starting places.
That's a good start. That's clearly a good start. And you know what's funny? Ask your cardiologist. Say, hey, do you by any chance you know any good health psychologist? And I invariably, they're probably going to say no, but your internist may know. But most major medical centers will be a great start, and your insurance company will also be a good start. And if you make two phone calls, you may find someone, and you can at least start that dialogue. But I think there's definitely a separate training. There's plenty of psychologists, but they do not have the background in health psych, particularly, or something as specific as cardiac psych.
Jeremy, if somebody sees you, what's going to happen in that first session with you?
Great question. I think the first thing is, depending on the original referral, Joel's going to say to his patient, look, you weigh 300 pounds, you got to go see chlorophene. And if the patient's like, okay, not a bad thing, gives me a phone call, we develop a little dialogue, and the person comes in and says, all right, what's going on? Now, clearly, they may walk in and say, look, you got to help me lose weight, and that's the primary thing. But I'll ask the patient, I go, what do you think the problem is? I literally ask that question. I go, what do you think the problem? What's going on with your health? What do you think's wrong? Sometimes they'll say, I think it's a weight. Sometimes they're going to say, my marriage is in the tank. I am depressed. I'm a mess. And we can't get to weight. Okay, they got marital problems that are amazing. Now, I'm not just trying to find a way to get in and treat their marriage, but if they're coming and saying, look, my marriage is a mess and I can't sleep at night because my wife and I are going toe to toe, how am I going to start working on? All right, start cutting back on your sugar. It doesn't make sense. So what you do is sometimes you do something very simple. You ask the patient what they think the problem is, and you know what? They may tell you. And you start working on that. Once you start working on it, you immediately start getting a bond. You start getting collaboration because you're saying, hey, let's start doing this. And usually you can start getting some traction, some clinical traction, some improvement. You start getting improvement in small areas. The patient is then dialed in and bought it. Sometimes I'll see a patient for three sessions, literally just say, hey, let's work on this one thing. And that helped out. Sometimes I'll see someone for 5 years, okay? Doesn't matter. My goal is to be expeditious, to be effective, and really be a resource for them.
So starting with what's most important to them, you're going to get more motivation from them anyway.
Easily.
And part of your philosophy, it's kind of like one of my book's baby steps, is to focus on one change at a time.
Have to. That's exactly what we talk about in our treatment chapters. It has to be one at a time. You know what? And once things start moving in the right direction, other things will fall into place. But they're moving in the right direction, and that's what's so key. It's like it's amazing. It is baby steps that you can have tangible change. Something as simple as getting someone to sleep. I was really fortunate to spend my training at here in Chicago Rush Medical Center 3 years in their sleep disorder service, which is phenomenal for a psychologist because they actually the psych department ran the sleep service, which is rare. But to get that training, so I spend a lot of my time trying to help people sleep. Do you know what it's like to get a good night's sleep, Mike? You know what people feel like when they get a good night's sleep? Boy, you know what happens? You know how people best way to manage stress? Get a night's sleep. Now that's not so easy. But try and help someone manage stress when they're getting 4 hours or they got sleep apnea. Yeah. They can't be done. So it's like, wait a minute, what's the core issue here? And then we got cardiologists saying, well, you need to start exercising. And then they have chronic low back pain because they have a disc they never treated. And they, oh, but you need to come back in 6 months and tell me how you've exercised. It's like, what? It's like, this is, it's almost negligent. It's embarrassing.
Problem is that it's not simple, as you were describing. There's often so many different problems going on all at the same time. I want to talk a little about self-image. With a man, it's easy to understand how frustrated they are that they can't lift for a while, they can't drive, their breastbone is fragile because it was cut open during a bypass, and they're taking tons of meds, and they're wondering if they're a man, and maybe the meds are making them impotent.
Mm-hmm.
Are there unique self-image problems for a woman who's had bypass surgery?
Joel?
Jeremy, this is up your alley, man.
No, it's both. You start out because you're going to see them on the front line. I'll get them on the back end, but what do you see the first?
You know, I think it's unique to each person. I can't answer that question. I mean, yeah, you sort of laid out the problems for the man, but they're, you know, depending on the woman, they can be very similar, depending on her role in the family, if she's the breadwinner or she's not the breadwinner. We talk about patients in the book where the bottom line is that for a man or a woman, you know, people come out of that just so completely psychologically messed up. You go in the hospital, you're feeling maybe okay. You come out, it's like we ran you over with a tractor.
If they had something like, if they had bypass.
Yeah, you know, everything hurts, you're a mess, and no one deals with the fact that, you know what, your life is completely different. It's kind of like this. Let's say you went and you bought a new car, and maybe you didn't want a new car, but you had to, your car broke down. And it's like leaving the dealership without a manual, with a key, and they say, okay, drive away. People need to know what to expect, what's going to happen next, you know, how their lives are going to change.
Right, but the body image thing, I mean, Joel's right, but
I start the process, basically, because I see them first, but I send them all to Jeremy, because it is a very complicated thing, and it is so, I believe, individually dependent. I mean, Jeremy, what do you think?
Well, yeah, but I think, Mike, there are it's depending on what the intervention is for the patient, you know, with the bypass, for the woman, a young woman. I have a kind of a unique situation. This is actually not a patient at Joel's, but a woman I saw through cardiac rehab, a very young woman who had profound cardiomyopathy, major, I don't know, she was like 31, and she, you know, she had her chest split open, and she's got a major scar that she has to deal with, and it does affect her. There's no doubt. You know, she's a recent mom, and it does impact her. Now, she does appreciate being alive because she has very serious heart disease. But at the same time, the things that we see more with the body image is more what you dialed into, Mike, is the notion of how the heart disease is really changing you functionally, more than the body image thing. That's really what I see, is that women, particularly, say, versus men, women are fatigued and feel sick for a long time post-operatively. They don't recover as quickly for whatever millions of reasons we can, some of it we've already commented on, but they don't feel good. And what Joel commented on is that the roles change. Like, the woman can't do everything now. She can't be all to everybody. That was her identity. And she's just 9 months post-op. She's still exhausted. Now, there could be many reasons why, et cetera. The meds, you know, the trauma of surgery, the trauma of heart disease. And she's still trying to recover, and that's psychologically just crushing her. And so there's a body image thing, but there's also that ability to function. And some people do recover, and they do get better, but they get better because they're actually addressing the things that they're supposed to address.
You know, Mike, it's a funny thing. You know, pretty much people are pretty limited with things they can do right after surgery. And I'll see people usually 10 days, 2 weeks after an operation in the office for the first time. Invariably, the man will ask the same question, and the woman will ask the same question. A man's going to want to know when he can have sex. He'll say that, and his wife looks at him like, are you out of your freaking mind? They just cut you in half, and all you think about is sex? And the woman's going to ask a question, you know, when she can sort of get back to living her normal life again. That's just so common. Happens almost every single time.
Yep. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, and I'm not trying to pick a fight, I'm just genuinely confused about this, is you ask a cardiologist about supplements, and they just roll their eyes and, well, I guess you can take that stuff if you want. I don't know if it does any good.
Right.
I go on the American Heart Association website, for example, and they're recommending fish oil. I even got a flyer from my cardiologist trying to sell me fish oil and other supplements. The same cardiologist that said, I don't know why you're taking that stuff. What should people be doing about supplements, and how do you intelligently...
Supplements are tricky. First of all, there's supplements and there's supplements. Fish oil it has been studied, and it's great for reducing sudden death. It's great for cholesterol. I don't look at that. That's pretty mainstream at this point. But as far as everything else, ginkgo and whatever.
Well, just a multi or vitamin.
You know, supplements in general. The truth is that they're not been studied. And in general, when patients ask me, I give them an easy answer that, look, I don't know enough about these things. And I can infer there's anecdotal evidence that they might be good, they may not be. The only thing I worry about is that supplements are not regulated by the FDA in general, meaning sometimes they can interfere with something I know they need to take. And that happens with coumadin in a blood thinner. Sometimes, actually, in some of these supplements, there's vitamin K, which antagonizes the coumadin, for instance. But in general, I have no problem with supplements. I'm never going to say that I understand them. I mean, like, some of these Chinese herbs have been around for 5,000 years. I am not going to sit there in the office and say, hey, these things don't work. Come on, there's a body of information that says they do. I just worry about that they might be counterproductive in certain circumstances.
One of the one that I hear or read so much about is statins depleting CoQ10. Is that a real issue, or do you think that's the supplement companies promoting a product?
I think there's not enough information out there. I'm well read in this. We all are, but there's not enough information to say that it's a problem. And then some people are saying, well, you have to give CoQ10 because it can reduce some of the problems with muscle aches. It just doesn't work. I mean, I've been giving statins out now for 20 years, and I don't see a lot of problem with the CoQ10 issues. It's like giving people, people with arthritis, they're gonna take shark cartilage, right?
Mm-hmm.
It can't possibly work. It goes in your stomach, it's digested into a bunch of amino acids, and it gets stuck in, who knows? I don't think a lot of this stuff probably doesn't work. On the other hand, we don't know the right doses of supplements. I was at a conference about 6 months ago, and this guy gets up, and there was a PhD pharmaceutical guy from Harvard giving the talk. At the end of the talk, there's two people who ask questions. Some people have actually some very smart things to say, but some people can talk at the conference because they can't get a word in edgewise at home. It was a second class. This guy gets up and he goes, doctor, I'm taking this supplement, this supplement, this supplement. He goes, what do you think? And the Harvard guy said, look, you're making very expensive urine. Because the bottom line is we don't know how much this stuff is to take, what's the right dose, what's the right preparation. So it's a very questionable field. In general, if people want to take it, why not? They're probably not going to hurt them.
Right, and I think it's also hit or miss. I think you just simply, the subjective report of, I'm feeling better after I take this, it's like, good. I mean, if there isn't something that's, Joel's comment about, the antagonist to coumadin, this is very dangerous. I mean, someone's taking a blood thinner and taking something that can make their blood even more thinner. There's all kinds of things that... Or vice versa. In some cases, it can actually aid in coagulation. So I think there are just some of those specific things that Joel's going to want to know. But I think there's no doubt anybody in the right mind can say, I know this works, is a little, we just don't. But truth is, if you got 10 people who take something like CoQ10 when they're taking a statin, there may be a percentage who are going to feel better. And we say, okay, take it, great. Right. But we can't, are we going to push it? Are we going to be like CoQ10, reps? No, we're not going to. But we're just going to have kind of an intelligent discussion about it and be rational and reasonable about it. But I think really what we do find out is that as we're living longer and, we're not moving our body and we're smoking and, we weigh 380 pounds, it's like, I don't think CoQ10 is your problem.
But another issue is that, people are taking multiple medicines.
Right.
And as they age, they're taking more and more. So I'll see people that are taking maybe 12 different medicines. And that gets very confusing for people, and it's a problem. And maybe
it's insane.
7 of them are supplements, which they maybe really don't need. And but they look at pills all the same. They get their pill box full of stuff, and they're like, I'll eliminate this or not eliminate that. So when it gets to be that kind of multiples, it is a problem.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I'm reading a lot about, too, is seeing inflammation the core problem with heart disease, and that maybe statins are primarily working just by reducing inflammation. Is that your read on it too?
My read is these guys have been trying to push the inflammation thing for about 12 years already. We've looked at all kind of biochemical markers. There's been studies done, and we can't prove it yet. The Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, I think they must have some big bucks invested in this because they're popping up with it again. The bottom line is that there's been a huge amount of incredibly well-studied randomized trials with statins. And the bottom line is statins seem to improve...
Post.
What's that?
Post-heart disease. Anyway.
Statins seems to work. If you take a statin, if you got heart disease, you're going to stay on the planet longer. But we don't know why. And it could be that they decrease inflammation. We don't know why. You know what? I don't think anybody knows. It could be inflammation. At one point, they thought it was a bacterial infection. They started giving patients erythromycin. Didn't quite work either. I'm not going to jump on any bandwagon I'm going to wait and see.
Okay. We'll get back to Dr. Ochner and Dr. Corafine in just a moment. Want to know what the future of therapy is? The place to find out is the 2009 Therapist Leadership Virtual Conference. It's April 20th through 24th. This cutting-edge conference has therapy superstars like Bill O'Hanlon, Chloe Madonis, Michael Yapo, Jeffrey Zai, and Ofer Zur, and many others. Rather than having to take time off work, take a plane, pay for a hotel, all you have to do is dial your telephone. And you can even attend in your pajamas you want. Because using Bridgelines, the faculty, including myself, present by phone with a question and answer session at the end of the presentations. You can also get an MP3 of the presentations and listen on your iPod. If you're a therapist, you'll want to be sure to catch this conference. And if you're a marriage and family therapist or a licensed clinical social worker in California or Florida, you can also get 16 continuing education credits. If you aren't a therapist, but you always wanted to know what therapists think and do, this is a great opportunity to learn about the cutting-edge thinking and practice in therapy. The conference focuses on positive psychology, family therapy, hypnosis, and practice building. Further information is on my website, agelesslifestyles.com. That's agelesslifestyles.com. Hope to see you at the conference. And now back to Dr. Ochner and Dr. Corafine. We've mentioned most of the psychological factors. One that we didn't mention is depression, which I assume is extremely common. Is there anything unique about depression in heart disease as opposed to a more generic depression?
Jim, let me just say one thing, if I may.
Sure.
I mean, I would just say that if you're walking on the street and all of a sudden your life is changing, you now have heart disease, you've had an angioplasty, you have a stent, you have a problem, you know, who's not going to be a little bit depressed about that? I mean, if you're not depressed, I think it's abnormal. So it's out there. Every one of my patients, I think, is depressed. Jeremy.
Wow, loaded question. The macro data is that people who have depression, who have chronic depression, have higher risk for heart disease, and they have higher risk for everything else, too. However, what we do know is that there is about a third of people, that you have a heart attack and then an intervention, say angioplasty, a stent, or bypass, a third of those individuals, we're not sure why, for 3-6 months, even to a year after, are going to have at least a moderate diagnosable depression, okay? Literally, they feel different. Like, biochemically, their bodies are different, their mind is different, their mood is different noticeably. It's not just Joel's comment, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I've had this, my life has changed. It's like anhedonia. They don't have pleasure. They're not doing the things they enjoy doing. They feel hopeless, helpless. Like, all the classic signs that there's actually a legitimate biochemical shift. It's like a trauma. The body went into some state, and a combination sometimes, whether it's therapy, whether it's even a short-term dose of antidepressant, which you got to be careful with as well, but whether it's 6 months or 9 months, people who get treated for it actually come out of it. Oftentimes people don't, but it's at least a third, a minimum, maybe even 40, but sometimes even 50%, that if you have this kind of intervention, a trauma like a heart attack, you will be depressed post-op. And it's definable, and it doesn't go away right away. And that's something that's different than some other procedures, or you ended up with a colonoscopy, or you end up with even colon cancer, or stage one, you got treated. You don't necessarily get depressed afterward. You know your life has changed, you got to make some dietary changes, et cetera. But there's something about that event, whether it's a heart attack or an intervention bypass, that people come out, and they're whacked. Okay, they have depression, and it's not like anything else. So, and they didn't have depression prior to coming in. And there's a lot of reasons that not going to go into all the details, but when you meet the individual, you start connecting the dots. They're like, this person is depressed. They need treatment. They need intervention. And cardiologists, once again, are not going to, you know, they're not going to come in and say, hey, doc, I'm really depressed. They want to come in and, you know, stiff upper lip and say, hey, I'm doing fine, when in fact their wives or the spouse is saying, this person's crying uncontrollably. They often don't admit that to their doc.
So the vast majority of people who have had a heart attack are probably going to have depression and probably really benefit from therapy and may need an antidepressant as well.
I think so. I don't know if it's at least a third to 40%. Absolutely, guaranteed, and at least up to 50%. Some of it's going to be just reactive, like, hey, this is a life change. Give them a month or two, and if they're not getting back or they're not healing, et cetera. But yes, Mike, that is correct. They are going to feel it, and it's real.
Yeah, some of it is analogous to grieving, that it's kind of an adjustment.
Exactly.
and you get over it, but you want to make sure that you decide accurately which one it is and get the heavy-duty help if you need it.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
We're talking with Dr. Joel Ochner, board-certified cardiologist who works closely with Dr. Jeremy Corafine, a cardiac psychologist, a rare breed. They practice in Chicago, host a two-hour call-in show, The Doctors Are In, on WKRS 1220 AM. And their wonderful book, The Noble Book on Heart Disease, gives the real nitty-gritty on what to expect and what's happening, all the things you wish your doctor told you. And the website is NobleDocs, NobleDocs.com. Gentlemen, thank you so much. Absolutely fascinating, and I love what you're doing. I hope that we get more and more cardiologists to do it.
We do, too. That's the idea.
We hope so.
No doubt. Mike, you've been great. Thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Bye now.
Bye.
Commentary. It's easy to miss how unique what Dr. Ochner and what Dr. Corafine are doing. First, they put cardiology in language that lay people can understand and use. In their book in particular, they take you step by step through exactly what happens physically and emotionally with various diagnoses, tests, and surgeries. That kind of information is surprisingly hard to find. The even more profound thing they do is address how heart disease impacts patients and their families emotionally. Unfortunately, cardiac psychologists are the exception rather than the norm in cardiac rehabilitation programs. Hopefully, their work will help get out the word on how important cardiac psychology is. Managed care initially offered great promise. Kaiser Permanente, in particular, was very good at offering supportive and preventive services to help subscribers avoid the even bigger problems down the road. Thus, managed care done right would encourage every heart patient to see a cardiac psychologist. But most of managed care deteriorated into cost containment. Consequently, we're left with a perfect storm that largely ignores psychological needs. Pharmaceutical companies advertise pills as the solution. Patients want pills and quick fixes, and compensation for doctors encourages five-minute medicine. Even the rehab programs have medicalized rehab and made it mostly about diet, exercise, and physical therapy. The Ochner and Corafine message is that pills may be necessary, but without addressing stress and lifestyle and exercise and nutrition, a heart attack or stroke is just around the corner. The same could be said for people with diabetes, but that's another story. My suggestion for finding a psychologist who's particularly familiar with heart disease is to contact a hospital's medical staff office and ask for a list of psychologists who are on the medical staff or affiliated with the hospital. Then you can match that list with the panel of providers that your insurance approves. There are two areas that I disagree with Dr. Ochner and Dr. Corafine. One is that from them seeing a never-ending line of heart patients, they've developed a perspective that everyone is stressed out and everyone is broken. Maybe most of us are, but I think there's a sizable number of people who are not. And it's important to focus on where we're going and what it looks like to have a healthy life with manageable stress levels and managing stress well. We need to believe that it's possible. We need to seek out role models of people who are doing that and examples of lifestyles that fit with healthy living. In short, I think it's important to focus on the goal that you want to achieve as opposed to the problem. My other disagreement is that while I understand that Dr. Ochner is being very honest and very scientific when he says the data on supplements are inconclusive, that leaves heart patients on their own on a very vital health decision. I would like to see cardiologists, and I'm speaking about cardiologists in general, provide some guidance as to which supplements appear to be helpful, which ones are very questionable, and which ones may actually do harm. Apparently, the most potential harm comes from people who take the anticoagulant or blood thinner Coumadin and then take supplements, herbs, or spices that also thin the blood. The list of blood thinning supplements and herbs and spices is very long. It includes aspirin and fish oil and vitamin E and St. John's wort and coenzyme Q10, Dong Quai, Feverview, garlic, curry, cayenne powder, ginger, paprika, thyme, cinnamon, dill, oregano, turmeric, licorice, and peppermint. And probably some more as well. Several supplements, herbs, and spices lower LDL cholesterol, and a few even raise HDL cholesterol and or help with triglyceride levels. And for a lot of people, the reason they're taking the statins is to lower the LDL levels and help lower the triglycerides. Just passing on the issue leaves heart patients likely to make decisions based on poor information. This is especially a problem as half of heart patients don't take their medications as prescribed, and many use supplements. This is not to take away from how overall I think what Dr. Ochter and what Dr. Corfine do is absolutely fabulous, getting concrete, usable information into the hands of consumers and helping people learn about the psychological part of heart disease. Baby steps. I always like to leave listeners with a little baby step that they can take to help them live a longer, healthier life, the goal of our program. Today's baby step, if you're over 40, even if you don't have heart disease, get a cardiogram every year. And also get a copy of the No Bull book on heart disease. Sooner or later, you're going to need it, if not for yourself, then for a family member or a friend. And if you do have heart disease, don't hesitate to see a psychologist, preferably one with training and experience with health problems. Just a reminder about the 2009 Therapist Leadership Virtual Conference on April 20th through 24th. This is a cutting-edge conference with therapy superstars like Bill O'Hanlon, Chloe Madonis, Michael Yapo, Jeffrey Zeig, and Ofer Zur. And it's a conference you can attend from the comfort of your home. All you have to do is pick up a phone. You can even wear your pajamas if you like. The conference focuses on positive psychology, family therapy, hypnosis, and practice building, and is cutting edge on what's happening in therapy. For information on the conference, go to agelesslifestyles.com. That's agelesslifestyles.com. And until next week, when we focus on how to survive a hospital stay, this is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricky, thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.